we have a group of experts to guide us through navigating the General Conference. On the panel, starting with my extreme left, is the Reverend Gary Graves. He is the petition secretary of the General Conference, meaning he read every petition that was sent. And next to him is Susan Brumbo. She is a jurisdictional delegate from New Mexico Annual Conference. She's also the coordinator of the calendar for General Conference. So she coordinates what goes on that calendar. And next to her is a man, the secretary of the General Conference, the Reverend Jerry Rest. And next to him, he is the man who handles the business aspect of the General Conference, the business manager of the General Conference, the Reverend Alan Morrison. The four are here to give us the presentation, which starts with something dramatic.
Whew. You sure gotta climb a lot of steps to get to this Capitol building here in Washington. Well, I wonder who that sad little scrap of paper is.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the Capitol City. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday.
Learned the legislative process from this video. Now you're all experts. From my time as a page with the Kentucky House of Representatives, from my polity class with my polity professor, who's been on the stage just before me, Dr. Frank from Candler. Through my work with Annual Conference and through the General Conference. So we are here today, Susan and I specifically, to share with you some of the process which takes the thousands of items which were mailed, emailed, or delivered to me over the past few months, and that process which turns them into the official actions of the General Conference. At this point in the process, we have received, reviewed, and processed all of the items which will be presented to the delegates of the 2012 General Conference. All petitions which were received prior to the deadline and which met the requirements of the Book of Discipline and the format designated by the Secretary of the General Conference are currently being translated and prepared for distribution to the delegates and other subscribers. Based on the paragraph assignments to legislative committees, these are the approximate numbers of petitions assigned to each committee. The numbers have been rounded to the nearest 10. For Church and Society A, 100. Church and Society B, 140. For the Standing Committee on Central Conference Matters, 20. For conferences, 80. Discipleship, 40. Financial administration, 90. Faith and order, 30. General administration, 110. Global ministries, 60. Independent commissions, 40. Judicial administration, 100. Local church, 80. Ministry and higher education, 180. Oh, some of you must be on that one. Superintendency, 50. That gives us an approximate number of petitions at this point of 1,120. 1,120 petitions. All petitions dealing with proposed restructuring of the ministries of the church have been assigned to the General Administration Legislative Committee, and the ministry study has been assigned to Ministry and Higher Education. Petition assignments will be reviewed by the Committee on Reference. That committee is nominated by the Council of Bishops and contains at least one person from each legislative committee who serves as a petition coordinator and assists the committee officers in the process of reassigning petitions from one committee to another. In addition to reviewing General Conference processes, we want to share with you some of the proposed changes to our General Conference rules. One proposed rule change allows for the training of subcommittee chairs in addition to the other committee officers. Under the proposed rule, subcommittee chairs will also be elected positions. In order to allow the committees to get a quicker start in dealing with legislation, petitions will be organized by subcommittee in advance. This is also necessary in order to determine the number of subcommittee chairs to be elected so that they can attend the training and to arrange meeting space and the necessary translators. Petitions will come from each subcommittee with an action recommended to the legislative committee. They may recommend to approve the petition, vote against the petition, amend the petition, refer the petition to a general board, agency, or commission, or request that the Committee on Reference reassign the petition to another legislative committee. The legislative committee will then act upon the petition, taking into account the recommendation of the subcommittee. The item will then print in the Daily Christian Advocate and will be ready for scheduling by the Committee on Agenda and Calendar. Another rule change proposed by the Commission on the General Conference is to finish all the work of the legislative committees by adjournment on Saturday evening. This change will allow legislative committee members to join all plenary sessions and ensures a dedicated day of Sabbath on Sunday. The Commission heard loud and clear the call for the Sabbath on Sunday. It will also... Very good. It will also assist the Committee on Agenda and Calendar to project more completely a full schedule for the second week's plenary sessions. Susan will be coming in a moment to share more of the process as petitions move through committee and to the plenary floor. But before she comes, I would like to thank several people. First, the staff at the United Methodist Publishing House, who served as my in-house IT department. And by in-house, I mean in the front corner of our family room, which is where the process happened this time around. Long story, I'll tell it to you later if you would like to hear it. UMCOM staff, who provides us our web presence and provides us an online submission process, which has become increasingly popular. I would also like to thank Bishop Davis and our cabinet and the local churches that I have served, who have shared me with the General Conference, because this is sort of a bivocational slash volunteer role. So there is a lot of understanding that comes and a lot of sharing going on. So thank you to all of those, to Jerry for allowing me to serve, and for all of you for your help with the process. And now Susan is going to continue our journey from the bill to committee.
Hi, my name is Susan Brumbaugh, and I served as the coordinator of the calendar for General Conference in 2008. I'm being nominated again for 2012, and I hope that I'll be elected on the first day. I work with the Committee on Agenda and Calendar, which is made up of members who are nominated by the Council of Bishops. We meet every morning of General Conference for the full two-week period, and once those legislative committee chairs are elected, they also meet with us and join us as we work through the planning of General Conference. In past General Conferences, the process has been that all petitions are considered by the legislative committees, and their recommendations are all then considered by the full body in plenary sessions, either through consent calendars for certain types of items with a great amount of committee support, or by being brought for discussion and individual votes to the plenary floor. As legislative committees work through their petitions and report out their work, their decisions on each item are published in the DCA. And in the proposed rules for 2012, the process for how plenary time will be handled is going to be somewhat different. The proposed rules specify that some committee items will not be scheduled for plenary time. These non-calendar items include Petitions the committee chose not to consider because they acted on another petition with the same subject instead. Two is petitions that were not supported by the legislative committee. And the third category is petitions that the committee did not have time to consider before that Saturday deadline. These non-calendar items will be published in the DCA so that you'll still be able to see what each committee did. I also want to let you know that non-calendar items can be put in the second and third categories. Those second and third categories can be put on the plenary calendar for full discussion by submitting a form with 20 active delegate signatures by the deadline specified in the rules. So there is an opportunity to have those heard if that's the will of the body. If adopted, these changes to the rules will make voting more straightforward for the plenary because delegates will only be considering items the legislative committees have supported or items that 20 delegates have supported and moved to adopt. It's a very proactive way of considering these items. For those of you who have been to past general conferences, this will help us avoid the confusing process of voting yes to support the committee when we mean no, that we don't support the petition. We've talked about these non-calendar items. Let me now talk about the calendar items. Certain types of items that have a great amount of agreement within the committee, less than 10 votes against the committee's recommendation, are grouped together in a consent calendar. The consent calendars are an efficient way for the full body to take quick action on items that don't require any discussion. The votes are taken no sooner than one day after a consent calendar is printed in the DCA. And those votes are taken during the report from the committee on agenda and calendar during the morning plenary session. Items can be removed from consent calendars by submitting a form with 20 active delegate signatures by the deadline specified in the rules. So we, again, have an opportunity to pull items out if they require discussion. Other petitions that are supported by the committee will move forward as individual calendar items so that they can be discussed and voted on by the full body in plenary sessions. 24 hours after items are printed in the DCA, they can be scheduled for plenary sessions. So during the second week, the Committee on Agenda and Calendar schedules blocks of plenary time based on committees and works with the legislative committee chairs to determine what order to consider each committee's items. In 2008, the Committee on Agenda and Calendar established certain priorities for items being heard before others, and these priorities have been added to the proposed rules for 2012. And they are, first of all, items affecting the global church, including constitutional amendments, items with financial implications because of the deadlines that we have, and items with minority reports. The Committee on Agenda and Calendar will work to make sure that there will be sufficient time to consider all of the calendar items that move forward from each committee. And we'll strive to communicate our plans for the plenary sessions with as much notice as we can. Thanks for your time and attention, and I look forward to seeing you in April.
Well, I'm very fortunate because I get to work with a wonderful team of people. I get asked, how large is my staff? And the reality is that between sessions of general conference, I really don't have any staff. In fact, I'm part-time pastor of a local church. But in terms of preparation for general conference, every agency staff person works for me. So I have this advantage. And I want to share with you the awesome joy of working with General Conference. I know sometimes people offer me sympathy, and sometimes I need the sympathy. But we're a wonderful church. It's a wonderful thing to see the delegates gather from around the world. In a couple of weeks, I'll be working with delegates in Manila, giving them orientation to General Conference. That wouldn't happen without the cooperation of the Connectional Table, United Methodist Communications, the Publishing House, the whole world of the United Methodist Church works together to get this done. I want to take a few moments to talk with you about some of the aspects of the rule changes. And one of them is that all these rules that we've offered to you as proposed changes work together. And if you decide you don't like a particular rule, a rule change that we're proposing, I ask you to consider carefully, if you want to change that, what its impact is going to be on other things. Someone says, I don't like having to have all of the legislation finished on Saturday, so let's do away with that rule. That means you're going to have some people, as happened last time, not in the plenary session, but in legislative committee sessions. You understand what I'm saying with that? Somebody may say, well, what about that 9:30 adjournment time that's on the agenda? We don't have to adjourn at 9:30. We can work late into the evening. Yes, you can. And you can produce some of the stupid results that we've produced in the past. I know the General Conference is all-powerful, but I want you to know that when you pass legislation that says certain percentages have to add up to certain numbers, and they don't, I don't know how to change the laws of mathematics to make that happen. And those things happen because, frankly, folks, we get overly tired. In every General Conference, we take somebody to the hospital. We don't take care of ourselves. And we claim to believe that God is in charge of our universe, and then at General Conference we act like a collection of practical atheists. So I would like to encourage you, I'm not telling you not to change the rules, but if you do decide you want to change one of the rules, think about its consequences, how it's related to all the other rule changes that we've proposed. One of the things that we're talking about, we've proposed to you, is that we add geographic representation in the administrative committees of General Conference so that every jurisdiction and every central conference is represented. We just think that's a matter of equity in process. We were charged by the General Conference to create a committee on ethics, and we thought about this, and, you know, who wants to add another layer of bureaucracy to something that's already incredibly complex? So what we decided to offer to you is the suggestion that we just make the Rules Committee the Ethics Committee for the duration of the General Conference and allow the Rules Committee that was elected in 2008 to be the Ethics Committee for 2012. It's a way of not spending any more money than we have to and getting the results we hope to get in terms of people who know what the rules are and people who are willing to invest their time and energy in the life of the church. That time for daily adjournment, by the way, and Alan's going to talk more about the time limits, but we're going to end the day with worship. I never understood why we came together in General Conference. We started the morning off with worship, and then we fizzled out. You know, we straggled out of the place with no celebration of the gift of the day that the Lord had given us. Now, of course, it serves the practical purpose that it closes the session, but it serves the spiritual purpose of making sure that we recognize the gift of the day that the Lord has given us. Gary's already mentioned that deadline for legislative work. And here's a couple pieces that I want you to pay attention to. If you want to be an officer in a legislative committee, we are saying, we think it's important that you attend the training. In fact, we think it's so important that if you don't show up for the training, we want to have another election to elect an officer who's willing to be trained. And any of you who have sat through a legislative committee session where the chairperson didn't know what the chairperson was doing will understand why this is important to us. This is a change that I think will greatly enhance the responsiveness and the speed and the care with which we consider legislation. We've already mentioned that we wouldn't have legislative committees doing their work during plenary sessions, and I think that gives every annual conference the representation to which they're entitled when the major decisions are ultimately being made. Now we've got it's time for my video. Can we get that on the screen over here? Yes, there's my video. I want us to look at this proposal for substitute motions, which is the same process that we want to use for a minority report, because a minority report is, in fact, a substitute motion. And look at the difference. We've taken a step out. And what we... Let me use an analogy. It was actually Gary's analogy to begin with. When you get up in the morning, do you go to the kitchen and start brewing a perfect pot of coffee and a perfect pot of tea, and after you have both brewed, decide which one you're going to drink? We're suggesting that when we have a substitute motion, for the sake of efficiency in operation, we decide right off the bat, which direction do we want to go? We can have a little debate on which direction we want to go, and then we make that decision, and then we perfect the piece that is the result of that decision. Some of you who have been around for a while know that we sometimes make the decision that we're going to have a substitute motion. We proceed to perfect the main motion. We proceed to perfect the substitute motion. And then we proceed to vote down the substitute motion. Then we proceed to vote down the main motion because we put poison pills in both motions. We're hoping that this will make a cleaner, more honest, and more effective process. There's one other little minor technical change in the rules that we're proposing, and that is that secretary staff will be permitted to speak in legislative committees in the performance of their duties without waiting to get permission from the chair of the committee. Now, that may not sound like it's significant, but let me just explain. We don't have enough staff to be everywhere at once. And we have had occasions where staff have been called to a legislative committee room and have been forced to stand and wait for 20, 30, and 40 minutes while a chairperson decided whether or not they were going to allow them to speak. And frankly, that interferes with the total efficiency of the operation of the General Conference. Now, they don't have the right to come in and express an opinion on legislation, but if they're called in for a technical matter, they'll have the right to speak without waiting to have a vote of the committee. Are we going to let Gary Graves speak to us today when you've called Gary into the room to ask him to speak? Okay. I understand there's been some concern about the ADCA, and I've had some concern about the ADCA, so let me, and I also understand there's been some miscommunication about that, not unusual in our life together. So let me share with you what's happened with the ADCA. And for those of you who don't know the code, that's the Advanced Daily Christian Advocate. Those are the books that you get that contain the information about process and the information about who the delegates are and the information of reports and petitions. They will not be out in print form on time. Again, in spite of the fact that the General Conference said they must be, and you are all welcome to vote to fire me in April if you choose to do that, the fact was, we got some huge pieces of legislation in the last days and are running an estimated 300,000 words more than we had last time. Now, it's not that we have a problem with the English version. The problem is getting it translated into French and Portuguese, and no matter how hard we try, we can't make it an instantaneous process. And so we've had to delay the publication of the material. We had to delay the publication of the English material because the pagination of the French and Portuguese and English must match. You understand what I'm saying with that? So you understand the complexity of the issue. The good news is that we will have the English edition online on the 25th of January, according to everything that I have heard from the publishing house, we've been in discussion about this daily, sometimes several times a day. January 25th, in PDF format, it will be downloadable. You will be able to print it. Although why you would want to print that many pages is beyond me. But it will be downloadable in segments. The handbook will be broken probably into two segments, and the rest of it will be broken into segments according to legislative committees. And the reason for that is nobody wants to sit at their computer for an hour and a half downloading a file the size we would be talking about. Plus, we want it to be downloadable for our friends, our delegates who are in other countries where networks may not be as effective. The French and Portuguese versions will be posted. All but at this point, it appears, and this is not a promise, this is a statement of appearance, all but one legislative committee will be able to be posted on the website on the 25th. The one legislative committee that will not be able to be posted is General Administration. And the reason you can guess is because that's where these huge petitions are being dealt with. And there is one petition that's still in the process of being translated. As soon as that's translated, we can finish the pagination for that section and print the whole document and provide the whole document. Alan's going to take us through the process of General Conference scheduled from opening worship to closing worship. So I'm going to turn it over to him.
Well, for those of you who have not paid attention too closely to the calendar yet, 95 days from now, we will be gathered upstairs in the exhibit hall, where we will be joining our hearts together in worship and preparing to receive the word from Bishop Goodpaster. I think he's working on his sermon right now, in fact. Oh, he's sending me an email. Welcome to the crowd. I might as well say the word, especially for those of you who are delegates. As my friend Jerry Reist reminds me, it's difficult to achieve perfection, and by the housing process, I've proven that I have not yet arrived there. Two other statements I would say to that is we've never done it that way before, and we will not be doing it that way again. But for those of you who remember the process 4 years ago when we had a third-party company that messed up the housing, it took them 8 weeks to straighten it out, so I'm very pleased that my staff was able to work with me to where we were able to take care of the initial registrations within the 14 days we promised. Thank you. I won't tell you how little sleep I've had in the last 2 weeks. That's a different issue. In your books that you received as a part of your packet for this meeting, on page 6, you'll find the agenda for the General Conference beginning there. What I really want to do, because I trust that those who will care enough to want to know the detail will read the detail, and, of course, that General Conference will have a version of this which will have room numbers for locations of things and so forth. But what I wanted to point out is basically just kind of an overflow of the days of the General Conference, especially knowing that there are some in the room who perhaps have not been through this experience before. We take over the convention center. We have the entire convention center starting the Friday before General Conference begins so that we can get rooms set up. We can create out of a concrete box upstairs called an exhibit hall into a holy space for us to gather together for General Conference. On Monday, there will be the Standing Committee on Central Conference Matters, the Committee on Reference, and the Committee on Calendar and Agenda will begin their work. And then on Tuesday morning, the rest of the administrative committees will begin their work in organizing each of their portions for General Conference. There will also be a number of orientations and briefings that will go on throughout those days leading into General Conference. And at 4 p.m., we will gather together for the opening worship and Holy Communion. Following the dinner break, we will then come back together for the organization of the General Conference. This is one of the changes that we've made in the schedule from last time. Last time we did both the opening worship and the organizing session in the evening after dinner, which makes for a very, very long evening. So we're in hopes that this kind of breaks it up a little bit so that we are getting a chance to absorb the motion of worship as we go and share fellowship with one another around the table, and then come back together and begin the hard work of General Conference. On Wednesday, it is the day in which we start putting into place the context of the work to be done. In the morning is what we have generally grouped together as a category of theological grounding, are the point where we receive the messages of the Episcopal Address, the Laity Address, of the Young People's Address. We get to experience together the Covenant for a Worldwide Church. And we also remember that day as we mark World Malaria Day in recognition. Following that morning together, we will then go to legislative committees, where you will have the opportunity to go through the process of electing your leadership for the work of the legislative committee. During the lunch break and throughout the afternoon, then those officers will be in training. This is something that the Commission on the General Conference has wrestled with greatly about. How do we balance the need for training with the need for other programming to be done and for some very important conversations to happen and to know that there is something for the other delegates to be involved with and doing so that there is not a substantial downtime? So I'm willing to say to you that this is not the perfect world. And so while the officers are being trained, we will be going on with other things, which means for those who have been elected as officers, you won't be a part of those other things. And we regret that. But we recognize that this is still the best course forward for the work of the church on this day. That afternoon, there will be two very important times of holy conversation. Those are non-legislative times. We will make use of the 13 spaces that will be used for legislative committees, but it will not be by legislative committee. Instead, you will be distributed across those 13 rooms, seeking to bring balance to each room and annual conference representation from around the world, seeking to bring representation of laity and clergy together in there, and as well the bishops will also be distributed across those rooms to be a part of those conversations. The first holy conversation will be on the foundation on identity and theology. It will be a reflective time of what you've heard in the morning addresses. We've never done it that way before. But when you think about it as a communication tool, one of the things that we learn about communications is that the best way for people to learn things is that they need to not only be hearing it, but that then they need to be reflecting upon it. They need to be sharing it out with others. And so that is a part of what that time will be, is a time of conversation of what are people hearing about who our identity is as United Methodists, as Christians in the midst of the world. That's an important segue to the work that you'll be then doing in your legislative committee work, because it reminds us of who we are and whose we are as we consider the legislation that has been submitted to the General Conference. The second conversation is a conversation on human sexuality. Friends, we know this has been a long conversation. As one who deals with the secular world often in making the arrangements for this event, I have conversations with people that look at me and say, well, do you think you're going to have stuff going on around homosexuality and other topics like that? And so we've been talking about it every General Conference since 1972. I don't think we're done yet. And so this will be a conversation to help further those dialogues, to recognize the various viewpoints from which persons are coming from. It will be a guided discussion time for us again to share life together. In the evening, we'll come back together in plenary session. You hear Mary Brooke Cassad refer to the critical choices in the church. It will be a time in which Connectional Table, GCFA, and the four areas of focus will help us to look at the choices that we face in the future as we move together in mission. And then we will conclude our evening with worship. Now, I didn't point out the one piece in the morning that I should have, but it holds true for every day, is that we are bookending each day in worship. The morning will be morning prayer. The evening will be the full worship service to remind us that each day and every day is God's day, and that as we gather together as the General Conference, we gather together as God's people. On Thursday and Friday, you will go, and Saturday morning, you will go immediately into your legislative committees. You will begin your time with morning prayer there, and then you will have the entirety of the morning and of the afternoon session to be able to work on legislation. On Thursday and Friday evening, we will come back together after dinner time to have plenary session and then our closing worship for the evening. On Thursday evening, the plenary session will be the time in which we'll have the nominations for the Secretary of the General Conference, for the Judicial Council, and for University Senate. On Friday evening, our time that evening will be in the act of repentance. On Saturday evening, we will not gather for a plenary session. Instead, that time will remain in the hands of the Legislative Committee so that you may go through concluding the work that you will be able to before your adjournment in that evening. This schedule, by doing it this way, as Jerry pointed out in the past, we've begun the morning with worship. We've spent much of the morning on legislative committee days doing other plenary work, oftentimes causing you to go about the work of legislative committee when you are at your tiredest. Our goal is to flip this schedule in such a way that it gives you the prime time of the day to be able to do your work. It's also one of the reasons why we believe it's so critical that we do adjourn each evening at 9:30 so that you have an opportunity to get a full night's rest. Our belief is that that will enable you to do your best work, to do it with clear thinking, and probably to do it with an attitude of willingness and conversation and collaboration because you aren't tired trying to do it. That it may change the attitude for all of us as we're not dealing with tiredness so much. On Sunday, the morning and afternoon are open Sabbath time for you. The Sunday evening does have a scheduled plenary session. It is a non-legislative time. It is an evening of celebration. It's also an evening of challenge as we look at the mission and ministry of the United Methodist Church. Friends, I need to say to you, this is a plenary session just like any other day. It is important that you are there, even though there will not be a vote cast. Because what we have done, again, listening to the concerns raised by delegates the last time, is we are taking all of those celebrative moments that we've tended to spread throughout the time of the General Conference that oftentimes begin to feel like interruptions to the flow of the legislation, and bring them into one grand evening. An evening in which we can celebrate truly who we are, the things that we have done, the things that we are doing, and the things that we are looking forward to do. And so we want to encourage you to make sure that each of your seats are filled at your tables. For those who may have been confused by the way in which this is printed, when you look at page 11, where it says the basic schedule for the remainder of General Conference, that is referring then to Monday through Friday of the second week. And then you will see that there are some specified items of business for each of those days for that Monday through Friday. Now, in terms of final adjournment, it will come when we're done. The Commission's hope is that we will be done before we break for dinner on Friday night. That's up to you. You're the ones who can make that happen. Or you're the ones who can decide that the evening will go on. Let me say a word about seating on the floor of the plenary. This time is a little bit different. We will not be sitting in the classroom style like you are right now. Instead, we will have round tables. They're actually a slightly elongated round table. If you've looked around the convention center, there's been a few rooms that you might see a circular with a couple of square sides on it. That's the tables that we'll be using, so that we're able to sit around on three sides of it. It'll put six delegates at each table. Again, one of the things that the Commission on the General Conference is seeking to do in the seating of the delegations is to try to get some more intermixing. But at the same time, we understand for the purposes of administering the delegation, you need to be together. So the way in which that works, and believe me, it was an interesting process to put together the seating plan, is that if you're a delegation, for instance, of six persons, you won't have all six persons at one table. You'll have three persons that will be on this side of this table and three persons that will be on this side of this table. So that you are still together, but you are able to engage then delegates who are from other conferences in the other seats. Now, where that doesn't work is in the larger conferences. If you've got 30, 40, 50 delegates, unless I just did a strip that ran the full length of the room, I wouldn't be able to practically do that. So in those cases, there are going to be some tables that will have all delegates from that one annual conference. But even in those annual conferences, the seats on the fringe of that block will be at tables that will be mixed. Let me also say a word about the facility here at Tampa Convention Center. They are in the process of upgrading some systems. We are not sure what systems will be in place. Some of you may be aware that the Republicans will be following us at this building a little bit later this year, so that's probably why the timing of upgrading some of those systems. We're hoping that we get to test some of those out. One of those is that it stands right now, this building overall does not have wireless available everywhere. It only has wireless, and it is free wireless that's available in the rotunda area that you come through the hall when you came to here. So there will not be free wireless available otherwise throughout the rest of the building as of this moment. I'll have to see what they get installed, when they get installed, and what can be made available, whether I'm able to do it free, whether it has to be on a subscription, and as I know that information, I will share that back with you. The other thing I want to share with you is that this convention center is friendly to religious groups as they recognize that we typically do not come to these events with the same kind of budget that a pharmaceutical group might come with, for instance. And so they have priced their meals at a very reasonable level. They will have offering of breakfast, lunch, and dinner here in the convention center. Their chef has already preset menus so that there is a rotating menu pattern, so it's not the same food every day. But there's, in essence, a blue plate special available for each meal, $10 a meal. Now, folks, do the math. You're getting paid $38 for your food per diem, so that works. That works. Now, we're not saying you have to stay here for your meals, with the exception of on the legislative committee days on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we are only doing a one-hour break, again, to maximize your time in legislative committees. We will provide the lunch that day to do that. And I've already been talking with the convention center to make sure that their caterer is really geared up for handling that. I'm going to go ahead and jump ahead to one other thing that actually is the next item after us to clarify. When Jim Harnish comes forward, he'll be offering words of greeting. There is on there a tour. This is a self-tour of the building. And so if you look in your booklets in the center section in 30, 31, and 32, you will find maps there of the facility along with charts of room assignments. Let me point out one thing for you so that it will alleviate some misunderstanding. When you see a room labeled for Legislative Committee Room Number 1, that is not an indication that Legislative Committee 1 is meeting in that room. That is a placeholder to make sure that I had 13 spaces set aside for the work of the legislative committees. Those assignments will be made in the weeks ahead. In case you've ever wondered how that comes about, it has to do with how many delegates are in the legislative committee, how many visitors do we think are going to be wanting to hear what's going on in that legislative committee, how many language groups need to be represented, because I can't put seven translator booths in every room that's available, and also how many breakout groups do we expect each legislative committee to need. And so we're in the process of gathering all of that information so that we can then assign which legislative committee will go in which room. And with that, I'm finished.
Let's give him another hand of applause for... I know that's a lot of information to absorb in such a short time. That's why we're going to have questions. So again, name, conference, and connection. We'll start with there, then we'll move here. And please, because of the short time we have, please make your questions very concise.
Eddie Fox, clergy delegate from Holston, and I'm speaking now to the process because that's a major change, and I'm not sure if it's written into the rules of our conference or simply a choice has been made. But I would ask a question because if I understand it, we're going to present a main motion, then present a substitute motion, and then we choose. Now, I don't know what the process is to choose, but if once you put something to a vote and you're asking people to vote on something before there's clarity or before it's been perfected, though that seems to be a long process, and there seems to be a definite order of the way we dealt with those issues, this seems to me to be a major move away from a process that we have followed for some time. I'm just asking the question, how will you choose the motion?
Eddie, the process is going to be relatively simple. The motion will be made, the substitute motion will be made. The people who are presenting them get to give their arguments as to why theirs is the motion that should be perfected, and then the body will vote to decide which direction it wants to go, and then they'll work to perfect the motion. It could still end up with a motion that was defeated, ultimately defeated, but the question would be for the body to decide which direction it wants to go. That won't be decided by the chair. It'll be decided by the delegates voting on the question, which direction do we want to go?
Thank you. Could we have this gentleman? Is that a follow-up? Is that a follow-up question or another question?
Yes.
Okay.
Which means that if the first motion that is chosen is voted affirmative, then the second motion will not be perfected, nor will it be considered for vote.
That's correct, but also if the second motion is one that's chosen, the first motion won't be perfected or considered for vote.
Thank you. This, go ahead.
Great Rivers, clergy. Susan, you gave us two examples of when 20 petitioners, 20 signatories could bring items to the plenary session. With efficiency of operation, one of our concerns, I'm wondering, why is that threshold so very low? And was there consideration to making that much higher?
I think what happened is that it's based on the previous rules to pull something off the consent calendar, and that was the threshold we've always had. And so when we added the ability to pull something off of the non-calendar, went with the same rule by default. Of course, the threshold could be raised by the body.
Let me add to that that one of the considerations was these calendars and the issue of items not being calendared is a new process. We did not want to create an appearance that we were trying to control what was considered. And so by leaving it at 20 this time, we felt that that would make clear that this is the same thing essentially we've done before. It's just a little bit different mechanically.
Thank you.
Rena Yoakum, Kansas East Conference. If I understood you, it was stated that the subcommittees for each of the legislative committees would be determined in advance. When will we know what those subcommittees are or how many there are for each legislative committee?
We'll be able to publish those when we've gotten, when we know how many delegates we have in each committee. Friends, I'm still trying to get delegate information from some of our
conferences that only met in December. So, you know, it takes our calendar for the general conference doesn't actually work smoothly with the way our annual conferences necessarily operate. So when I have all of that delegate information, Gary Graves and I will sit down with Alan Morrison, and we will say, well, actually, we'll probably do it by telephone, unless we do it in March when we're meeting the next time. But these are the number of delegates that have to be in the rooms. This is how, you know, obviously, if you have a lot of delegates in a legislative committee, they can break up into more subcommittees than if it's a small one. How many petitions ultimately do we have, and how do they break out? Because we don't want to take a bunch of petitions and split them up in such a way that one subcommittee is dealing with the same paragraph as another subcommittee. We want one subcommittee to be dealing with all the legislation in that paragraph, at least insofar as humanly possible to do so. I would hope that we would be able to publish that information in March.
I'll hand over there, and then we'll come.
Kim Reisman, Indiana Conference. And I know I'm showing my ignorance in parliamentary procedure, but I just want to make sure I understand exactly what you said, and I think I'm a little confused in my own mind. The substitution motion that we just talked about, that's a plenary issue, or is that same process apply to the legislative groups?
It would apply within the legislative committee as well.
Committees as well, okay. And then the second related question is, that's not the same thing as a minority report, correct? Those are two different things, a substitute motion and a minority report. Those are two separate things. Is that correct?
No, Kim, under Robert's Rules of Order, a minority report is a substitute motion.
It is. Okay, so then when a legislative committee brings something to the body and there is a minority report, before any work is done, we'll just decide between the two and then begin.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's the idea.
Okay, thank you.
And frankly, folks, some of you have been through that. You know how we can spend 2 hours in the process of perfecting two different motions and then defeating them both. And we just figured, you know, if we spend an hour and defeat it, it's not as much lost time.
I'd hand over the... Yes, go ahead.
I'm trying to understand the seating. I can't quite picture that in my mind. And I know my delegation. I'm Tom Berlin. I'm from Virginia. I'm a clergy delegate. And I'm also trying to understand the ergonomics of that. It sounds to me like some of us will be sitting sideways to the front. Is that accurate?
It would be more like... It'd be more like along this lines where... Yeah. Yes, you're going to be angled slightly for the person that's on the very end, but it will be around. It will be around the three sides. There's some of the times in which that really we are looking for conversation between the delegates, and that this will start to empower this. Friends, again, this is one of those things where we don't know whether it will work, but the commission has had some great conversation about it. They themselves have been delegates, and they are in hopes that this may build a different relationship for us as a general conference. And it will be evaluated as we see it unfold, and then we'll decide whether we do it again.
All right. Let's have a question here, and then at the back before we come to the side.
Robert Beckham, South Georgia Conference. Did I understand correctly, with a smaller delegation like we have in South Georgia, where we have less than 13 delegates. We don't cover all of the legislative committees. We could have a delegate reserve sit in the committee with voice but not vote. Is that correct?
That is not correct.
Where did I read that? I got that misperception in the rule changes.
Let me clarify. Under the rules, a delegate may go to another legislative committee on behalf of their annual conference with voice but without vote. A reserve delegate may be seated as an observer in a legislative committee, but they do not have voice unless, of course, for some reason, somebody in the legislative committee would ask they be given voice.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
What's up?
Joe Harris, Oklahoma Conference, delegate and communicator. a question about the parliamentarians. How will they be chosen for the legislative committees?
Okay, I shouldn't have moved things. There we go. The parliamentarians, under the rules of the General Conference, are retired bishops, and or there is the possibility of including other clergy or lay if there are not enough retired bishops available to serve in that capacity. We're in the process of ascertaining exactly how many retired bishops we will have available to serve in that way. For any involvement by other lay or clergy, we would look at people who have been delegates in the past but are not currently, nor are they reserved currently. We wouldn't use persons who have status, that have potential status of voting in that capacity.
Thank you.
Brad Lorvik, Rocky Mountain Conference, clergy delegate. I want to check in. I have deep concern about the lack of Wi-Fi, especially as we discuss things like table situations where we'll be physically separated from other parts of our delegation in certain situations. Things like this where, I mean, we're talking about holy conferencing, discernment. We've got folks in our delegations who are in other rooms at other times, and things come to the floor. We need to be able to connect. I think about the conversations that go on Twitter and other places where I'm very deeply involved in the discernment that we're in part of. And then to hear that we're not certain if it'll be present or if it'll be subscription or the other options you laid out, especially things like it'll be available by subscription if you're willing to pay for it. That affects our budget as a delegation, my own personal budget related to things. I mean, these are things I'd be interested to hear a little bit more detail of, when decisions will be made, what information will be available to us, and if it's actually a priority for others.
Understand that we are in a changing phenomena of the world. When this location was selected, that was 3 years ago when wireless was much less of a question or a concern. I want to acknowledge the context of decision-making of how we get where we are to start with. The facility is the facility. It offers what it offers. Can we come in and put in our own wireless network? Yes. That has substantial budgetary impact to the budget of the General Conference. Because, frankly, the wireless network that some of you are making use of right here, right now, is one that UMCOM set up for this event. That cost a couple of $1,000s for them to do what needed to be done for that. That would not be a system that would be adequate to the needs of a plenary hall that is going to have potentially 4,000 persons in it trying to access wirelessly. So I want you to understand the mechanics of it. And I also want you to understand that, you know, I am responsible for managing the budget of the General Conference. We have had a history of deficits, and I'm trying to do my best not to let that be the case again. And so that's part of what is involved in those decisions.
We have time for two more questions. I've read Lewis come up, but what's the... Before she asks a question, I'd like to have the Reverend Hamish from the host committee to get up here to prepare to give us a briefing. Go ahead.
Joan Carter Rimbach, clergy delegate at Baltimore Washington Conference. It is Purple Friday in Baltimore, so there goes the purple. Alan, have a question for you. I know there are two times when we'll be in holy conversation, two evenings, one on the human sexuality. Can you share with us who is preparing that? How is that going to be done? And will it take into consideration that it's not an issue, but it's about not about people, but we should be in conversation with people?
Yes, and thank you. You helped me realize that I forgot to point out a third holy conversation time, which is Monday evening. That one will be around our global nature of the church. The two conversations on that Wednesday afternoon are being planned and guided by the Council of Bishops Unity Committee, Unity Task Force, I think is the correct name. They actually are the group who has been, in particular in the issue of human sexuality, has been working in dialogue with various groups around the church of what the issues are, of what some ways forward may be. And so they're pretty versed in understanding what's coming to the table. And so they're laying out the work for that and how it will be guided through that discussion time.
Yes. Yes, you can have the last question.
Scott Campbell, I'm a New England clergy delegate, and I'm not sure whether this question is appropriately addressed to this group or not, but perhaps someone can take a stab at it. One of the things that I have very much appreciated about today has been the opportunity to hear counter perspectives to some of the major pieces of legislation that are being proposed. And I note that the Connectional Table is going to be doing an all-day briefing of international delegates on the Monday before conference convenes. And the note says that this may include discussions of proposed legislation, the Connectional Table being one of the proponents of that major legislation. I'm wondering whether there will be an opportunity for the same kind of counter perspectives to be presented in that setting as we have had here.
Great question. You may notice that there are two red lights that we're looking at from where we're sitting in the back of the room on top of cameras that are recording us. And part of the purpose of that is that there are many segments of this event that will be a part of the briefings that are being presented in the Philippines in the first weekend of February, in Harare, Zimbabwe, on the second weekend of February. So it will be many of the same presenters who have been presenting here during this time that will be a part of both those opportunities as well as the briefing the Connectional Table is sponsoring on that Monday. Let me say a word. I'm thinking of my spokesperson training and what I should or shouldn't say. Well, I want to say a word in defense of the Connectional Table. Yes, they are a submitter of legislation, as are many other bodies. But I want you to know that those briefings, while they are a primary sponsor for it, which means they put some dollars into funding those briefings happening, that in fact, actually, the design team for it has been the same folks that have been working with this event as well. So it is not about putting any particular one particular group in front of another, but about presenting a balanced view of the various legislative pieces that are under consideration.
Thank you very much. Before I let Gary, Susan, Jerry, and Alan leave, I'd like to invite the host committee, Jim Hamish, who is the chair, to give us a few words, and after that, I have some important announcements to make for us before we end our day.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to Tampa. Please. There is a significant etymological debate about the meaning of the word Tampa. The best guess is that it was a Calusa Indian word lost somewhere in the dark ages of the past that meant sticks of fire. And if you go to the campus of the University of Tampa, while you're here, you'll see a statue or a piece of sculpture that is supposed to be the fire sticks that the name may represent. The Spaniards found it that way, and you can find that history at a very fine history museum just a little bit away from here. Then there's the history of this mythical era in which Tampa Bay was invaded by marauding, raping pirates, one of whom was supposedly named Jose Gaspar. And you have the privilege of being here at the beginning of Tampa's Gasparilla Festival. Tomorrow, if you happen down the Bayshore, is the children's parade. Several hundred thousand non-alcoholic children. In contrast to the Gasparilla Parade, 500,000 very drunken, marauding pirates invading the city. And therefore, we have a football team that can't win football games, but that is called the Buccaneers. Then in the 18th century, the Cubans came, and for many, you would know, some would know out of personal experience, that Tampa has been called the Cigar City because during that era it was the center of the making of very fine Cuban cigars that went all around the world from Tampa. And then later along came all the rest of the settlers and then Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders, who resided at the what is now University of Tampa during that era. And along there came the Italians, who brought in the mafia. And Tampa has a wonderful history of underground mafia, complete with hidden tunnels under Ybor City. That is supposedly the way they escaped. That tradition passes on in that the Republicans will be coming in August. I would say the same thing with the Democrats. I've been telling people that there are two major events in the convention center this year. One is more highly political than the other. That would be the United Methodists. Because the political conventions have no real decisions to make, whereas this group really does. And so if you want the more political of the two, it's easy to know which one to choose. So welcome to being a part of the fascinating life and history of this community. The host committee has been very intentionally and very prayerfully preparing itself to offer you the warmth of hospitality of the Sunshine State and of Tampa Bay, and we look forward to your coming. There have been two texts that have grounded us in our preparation, and I offer them to you out of the life of the host committee. One is that wonderful moment in the 22nd chapter of St. Luke's Gospel when Jesus says to a couple of the disciples, now we've got to find a place to have the Passover, and here's how you're going to find it. You'll go into the city, and you're going to find a guy there with a jug on his shoulder, and he's going to lead you to a guest room, an upper room, and a house, and that's where I want you to go prepare for the Passover. And they find the guy with the jug on his shoulder. He leads them to the upper room, and that is, in fact, the place where bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ. And our hope and prayer has been that we as a host committee would be that guy with that jar on his shoulder. That our task is to prepare an upper room. We are on the second floor here, as you'll see, where perhaps by the alchemy of God's Spirit, the real tangible stuff of our lives might indeed become a living expression of the body and blood of Christ. The other text is from Habakkuk. The prophet prays, revive us again in our own time. And we've been daring to pray that this might be one of those moments when the Spirit of God moves in ways that we have not manipulated, planned, politicked, or legislated for, and that perhaps the sticks of fire will fall again on Tampa, and that we might experience some refreshing fire of the Holy Spirit in this place. That's been our hope and our prayer. And so we look forward to your being a part of that that coming. There are ways in which you can participate in that. If you have spouses or friends who are coming to town and want to know what they can do when the legislative committee meetings are really boring, we would love to invite them to join our volunteer force. We're in the process of recruiting 2,000 spaces for volunteers. And genuinely, the invitation is out there for if you have family members or somebody who would like to be actively involved, we invite them to go to the conference website, flumc.org, where you'll find a place that they can choose something that matches their gifts and participate in the hospitality while they're here. At which point I introduce Marilyn Swanson. I have been saying that I'm like the hood ornament on a very fine automobile. It looks like I'm out in front, but somebody else is actually running the machine. And it's Marilyn and Sandy and our conference staff who have taken care of the details of this process with a kind of creativity and care that represents their life in Christ and their life among us. So we welcome you here. Was there something else I was supposed to say? Oh, yes. I always turn to Marilyn to say, now what should I be saying? And we welcome you into churches in the area on Sunday the 29th. The congregation that I serve is six blocks removed from here. but we can't get you all in there. And so there will be churches from the surrounding area that will be available for you as places to worship on that Sunday morning, the 29th, and you'll be receiving information about how you can sign up for them to pick you up and take you there. Otherwise, we'll be happy to tell you our favorite restaurants. We'll be glad to tell you the places not to go, and we look forward to welcoming you with expectation that God's love and light might once again fall like fire, or if you prefer hockey, like lightning on the city of Tampa. Thank you.